You've heard it said, the human heart is an idol factory. It comes from a longer quotation by the pastor John Calvin, who said, man's nature, so to speak, is a perpetual factory of idols. Every one of us is, even from his mother's womb, an expert in inventing idols. Another pastor theologian, John Wesley, observed similarly. He said, in his natural state, every man is born into the world a rank idolater. The subject of idolatry has come up several times in Isaiah. Idolatry is not a modern problem. Israel was regularly pulled into the sin of idolatry. That's partially because of human nature. As those pastors had observed, our hearts are always seeking to make gods for ourselves. But it's also in Israel's case because they were surrounded by idolaters. The Canaanites worshipped Baal. The Babylonians worshipped Marduk and his son Nebo, the god of learning. The Assyrians had many gods. Asher was their national god, but they worshipped Nebo as well. They worshipped Sin, the moon god, Ishtar, the goddess of lust, and Ninurta, the god of storm. It's probably the case that you're not very tempted by those false gods today. I doubt there are many of you who have felt a strong pull into the worship of Ishtar. And yet, idolatry is still a problem. What about the gods of recreation? What about the god of self? What about the god I mentioned last week, the god of moralistic, therapeutic deism? What about the god of possessions and materialism? These gods tempt us still. Now, we know that idolatry is wrong. For nothing else, we know it's wrong because God legislates against it. He commands us not to make idols, not to have them, not to worship them, not to bow down to them. So a sermon that emphasizes the sinfulness of idolatry would probably not be the most useful thing for us. But you may notice that the passage itself didn't emphasize the sinfulness of idolatry, but rather the futility of it. Or to put it another way, Isaiah's primary point, what he emphasizes, is that the problem with idols is that they're dumb. Idols are dumb. Worshipping idols is dumb, and those who worship them will become dumb. And dumb is meant to have a double meaning here. When you say that idols are dumb, they mean it in the technical sense, that idols cannot speak. They cannot act. They cannot do anything for you. An idol cannot have a plan or a desire, and it cannot execute a plan or a desire. They are, by definition, dumb. But Isaiah will make the point that those who worship them are dumb in the vernacular sense of the term. It's a stupid thing to do. And yet we do it anyway. Verse 9 is a summary of the argument that Isaiah will lay out in this lengthy text. He says, all who fashion idols are nothing, and the things they delight in do not profit. Their witnesses neither see nor know, that they may be put to shame. An Old Testament scholar, Alec Moyer, helps us categorize some of these claims that Isaiah is making. And he shows that the verse covers the one who makes the idol, the idol itself, and the one who worships the idol. That is, the dumbness applies all the way around, start to finish. And God hates idolatry, frankly, at least in part, for just this reason. You take something that is dumb. You take something that cannot speak, that cannot act, that cannot do anything. And you give it glory as if it's God. That's an offense to what God really is. One of the reformers said, nothing is as inconsistent with the majesty of God as images. And yet when we worship them, we try to shut God up in some little thing. Isaiah says that the idols are dumb, and that we, when we worship them, are dumb as well. He'll set forth a two-point objection, two reasons why it is the case that these idols are always dumb. The first is that an idol can't rise above its human origin. Look, beginning in verse 10. Who fashions a god or casts an idol that is profitable for nothing? Behold, all his companions shall be put to shame, and the craftsmen are only human. Let them all assemble, let them stand forth, they shall be terrified and put to shame together. The ironsmith takes a cutting tool and works it over the coals. He fashions it with hammer and works it with his strong arm. He becomes hungry, his strength fails, he drinks no water and is faint. The carpenter stretches a line, he marks it out with a pencil, he shapes it with planes and marks it with a compass. He shapes it into the figure of a man, with the beauty of a man, to dwell in a house. Isaiah wants us to think logically about these idols. They have their existence because a human made them. Their creator is human. Idols are the creatures of human creators. But we ourselves are creatures. Our energy does not come from within ourselves, but it's given by the one who made us. Our ability to create is not intrinsic to ourselves. It's given to us by God. So how could human strength, human effort, human design ever create something that is more than human? It can't. The verses lay out a very careful exercise. Skilled iron workers, skilled carpenter, being very careful, doing things by strict technical specifications. And what he creates can be beautiful. It says the figure of a man with the beauty of a man. But it's still just the creation of a human. When we're trying to create gods, we're looking for solutions to spiritual problems. God solves a spiritual problem, which is alienation from Him in our sin, that emptiness we feel apart from God, that condemned condition in which we stand without forgiveness. These are all spiritual problems. And yet we will regularly, like Israel, look to material things to solve a spiritual problem. One scholar says, our idol may be awesomely impressive in beauty, or it may be terrifyingly horrific. But either way, it is only the product of a carefully drawn blueprint and a competent human designer. That's the best we can do. The best result of human effort is always, at best, human. And usually, subhuman. These things cannot be worthy of worship. These things cannot be worthy of the glory that belongs to God. Nothing we create can make or sustain life. Nothing we create can bring salvation. Nothing we create can bring the restoration of all things. And that's what we need. As we live as broken people in a broken world, separated by God because of our sinfulness, experiencing all kinds of horror in this world, whether it's broken relationships or mass killings, because of the effects of the curse, what we need are spiritual solutions, reconciliation with God, the recreation of all things. You cannot look to the material to bring a spiritual remedy. Pleasure is satisfying, but temporary. Money is useful, but limited in function. Relationships can be great, but they're subject to human weakness and sin. Creating idols out of any of these things is a recipe for disaster. And getting back to Isaiah, it's just dumb. The second reason he says that idols are dumb is that they cannot rise above their material basis. Just as they can't rise above their creator, they can't rise above what they're made out of. Verse 14, he cuts down cedars or chooses a cypress or an oak and lets it grow strong. He plants a cedar and the rain nourishes it. Then it becomes fuel for a man. He takes part of it and warms himself. He kindles a fire and bakes bread. Also, he makes a god and worships it. He makes an idol and falls down before it. Half of it he burns in the fire. Half of it he eats meat, roasts it, and is satisfied. Also, he warms himself and says, I'm warm. I've seen the fire. And the rest he makes into a god, his idol, to fall down and worship it. He prays to it and says, "Deliver me, for you are my God." What we make idols out of are material things. And so it's limited from the start in what it can do, and yet we make them anyway. One of the ways to understand what Isaiah is saying here is that because this thing, which in this case is a tree, had given him so much material benefit, he then turned to it for spiritual benefit. Well, the tree had solved my food problem. I was able to cook food on it. It solved my coldness problem. I was able to sit by the fire and be warmed. And so surely this object that can meet those needs can meet my spiritual needs as well. It's a very similar way that we get trapped in idolatry. Is there are things in our life that meet certain needs that we have. And those things can be good. They can be God-given. They can be useful to us, whether it's money or relationships or our work or our family or whatever it may be. We think that because they meet one kind of need, that they're all we need. And so we call out to it, as does the fool here in verse 17, "Deliver me, for you are my God." But this is dumb. It's just wood. It can't do anything beyond meeting the specific physical needs. And it only does that because God gave that physical object for our good. This is why Paul says in 1 Corinthians 8, that in the new covenant, it's no problem to eat meat that was sacrificed to idols. In a sense, Paul says, what difference does it make that meat was sacrificed to idols? Meat is meat. Somebody put it in front of a block of wood or a bronze statue. What difference does it make? Those things aren't real. There's no spiritual significance to those items. Idols are dumb. They must be dumb. Unable to speak. Unable to act. Unable to meet spiritual needs. They must be this way because they're created by men, by creatures. They can't rise above us and become our gods. And they're made out of material things. They cannot become spiritual. And so Isaiah concludes his argument by revisiting those points, but by showing the tragic consequences of idolatry, how this dumbness will come full circle. He says in verse 18, "They know not, nor do they discern, for he has shut their eyes so they cannot see, and their hearts so they cannot understand. No one considers, nor is there knowledge or discernment to say, half of it I burned in the fire, I also baked bread on its coals, I roasted meat and have eaten, and I shall make the rest of it an abomination? Shall I fall down before a block of wood? He feeds on ashes, a deluded heart has led him astray, and he cannot deliver himself or say, is there not a lie in my right hand?" The result of idolatry is that we become enslaved to the dumbness of the idol. That we ourselves become no longer able to speak or to think or to act. We become slaves to this dumbness. He says that our eyes become shut. And he gives the example here. He uses the exact same verses as he did before, where he talks about a man in a situation who takes a piece of wood and half of it he's going to use for good purposes, for God-honoring purposes. He's going to use it to cook his food and to be warm. And then Isaiah begins to paraphrase a little bit. He shows you what should have happened had the person been thinking logically. This same tree, this same piece of wood that I just cast into a fire and burned to cook my lunch, I'm going to bow down to it and pray to it like it's my God? That's absurd. It's self-evidently absurd. And yet he says his deluded heart has led him astray. He cannot deliver himself, and so he calls out to this piece of wood to be his deliverer. It's blindness. It's blindness that many of us have probably experienced. When you go down that road of idolatry, when you put something in the place where God ought to be, whatever it is, there comes a point where you stop thinking rationally. You stop thinking logically. You don't try to explain your actions to other people, because if you did, you know that it wouldn't make any sense. You're in the grip of this idol. That's actually the irony of this. He uses that language of, is there not a lie in my right hand? And it's this picture of how we think we can hold up these gods, hold up these idols, and they're in our hand. We've got control of them. But in reality, it's got control of us. It's got a grip that we cannot break. It's no different with our idols. If we looked at them logically, if we were being reasonable, we would conclude that it's stupid, that it's dumb for us to give so much power to this thing, to make decisions about our lives, to make choices, to make actions based on this thing that cannot help us and that cannot save us. We prioritize things in our lives that ultimately can be no aid. We elevate things that are good or useful for a purpose, but we elevate them to a place of hope and salvation in our lives, and it's not going to work. This is why for so many people, the traditional Christmas season can actually be a pretty depressing time. Because people convince themselves that they can fill that void that they feel. They can solve the spiritual problem that they have with generosity or with spending time with family, relationships. But it won't work. Those are good things. They're good gifts from God that are meant for us to enjoy, but they're material things. They cannot solve a spiritual problem. These things are dumb. And we end up being dumbly in their grip. Contrast that to what Isaiah says about the living God. Verse 21, remember these things, O Jacob and Israel, for you are my servant. I formed you. You are my servant, O Israel. You will not be forgotten by me. I've blotted out your transgressions like a cloud and your sins like mist. Return to me, for I've redeemed you. Sing, O heavens, for the Lord has done it. Shout, O depths of the earth. Break forth into singing, O mountains, O forest and every tree in it. For the Lord has redeemed Jacob and will be glorified in Israel. Thus says the Lord, your Redeemer, who formed you from the womb. I am the Lord who made all things, who alone stretched out the heavens, who spread out the earth by myself, who frustrates the signs of liars and makes fools of diviners, who turns wise men back and makes their knowledge foolish, who confirms the word of his servant and fulfills the counsel of his messengers, who says of Jerusalem, she shall be inhabited, and of the cities of Judah, they shall be built, and I will raise up their ruins, who says to the deep, be dry, I will dry up your rivers, who says to Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and he shall fulfill all my purpose, saying of Jerusalem, she shall be built, and of the temple, your foundation shall be laid. Our God is something altogether different from these idols. These idols have been described throughout as dumb. It's a block of wood. It's a piece of bronze. It's a 401k account. These things are dumb. They cannot help you. They cannot save you. But our God, He's altogether different. There's lots of reasons why our God is different, but Isaiah really hones in on one. And if you're going to pick one, what a one he has picked. That our God is different because He has a plan for redeeming His people. And Isaiah insists that we ought to remember this, that when we are tempted by idols, that when we feel our allegiances being challenged, that when we see our priorities getting out of line, the thing that we ought to remember is that God has a plan to redeem His people. And whatever the problem may be on an earthly level, whatever we believe is a makeshift solution we can create, whatever idol we can make to satisfy that one issue, it will ultimately fail to save us. But God will not fail. That's what chapter 46 of Isaiah is all about. Just reading a verse from that. Chapter 46, 8 and 9. Remember this and stand firm. Recall it to mind, you transgressor. Remember the former things of old. For I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is none like me. Declaring the end from the beginning. at the end of the chapter we've been dealing with, where it talks about Cyrus and it talks about Jerusalem, it's God asserting that He's the one in control of all of this. Whatever it is, whatever difficulty that presents itself, whether it's relationships, whether it's provision, whether it's sickness or even death, whatever problem it is that presents, God doesn't minimize it, but He proclaims His lordship over it. Israel will be redeemed from Babylon. He said that in chapter 43 about how Israel, who looks like they're going to be wiped out by Babylon, it's not going to happen. He has a plan and it will come to pass. More importantly, here in chapter 44 and verse 21. Remember these things, O Jacob. You are my servant. I formed you. I have blotted out your transgressions like a cloud and your sin like mist. Return to me, for I have redeemed you. He has promised redemption. In Christ, He has accomplished redemption. His people will be saved from their sins. He will not forget us. What a timely message that is. An idol doesn't know you. It can't think. It can't speak. It can't make promises. It can't act on them. And it cannot remember. But our God, the God who says He has redeemed you, He will remember you. He will not forget. Though we are faithless, He is faithful. And what's more, His purposes will stand. When He says it, it will happen. He confirms the word of His servant. He fulfills the counsel of His messenger. He says to Jerusalem, there's no ambiguity here, she shall be inhabited. God will bring about what He has promised. And it's quite a contrast. Santa can bring us presents. Giving money to the man ringing the bell outside the stores can give us a warm feeling like we've done something good. Spending time with family this week can remind us of love and acceptance. But these things cannot save. If you look to these things as the answer to your spiritual dilemma, you've done a very dumb thing. These idols can do nothing. These idols are nothing. And these idols will bring us to nothing. But by contrast, the true and living God, He will redeem His people. He will not forget you, but will remember you and will speak kindly to you. He will redeem His people and He will allow us to share in His very real glory. Let us not forget that along with our redemption comes sharing in the glory of God. And so the choice before us is pretty clear. Redemption and glory with Christ, or dumb idols. Thanks be to God that He has not left us to the things that we make, but He has redeemed us and made promises to us and will remember us forever.